And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll start with persistence. Specifically, what does it take to keep a television show going for season after season after season? Are most shows doomed to peak after only a season or two? And then in honor of G.I. Joe Retaliation, we'll talk about some red flags like sequels with silly subtitles. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I edit coverage of movies, theater, pop culture, and other things as the mood strikes.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
The band is back together.
It is. I listened to last week's show, and I loved it. Petra Mayer did a great job. Jess Gittner did a great job. But I kept wanting to jump into the discussion when I wonder what Steven thinks of Billy Joel.
Exactly.
Was that somebody actually said that. It was like, where's Steven?
And see, when you do that as you're driving along the highway, people think you're strange.
It was your poochie fantasy.
It was my poochie fantasy come to life. I have opinions on Billy Joel. Okay, I've actually got a Billy Joel theory. If Billy Joel's body of work were a gigantic bowl of milk, and it is. The songs Uptown Girl and We Didn't Start the Fire are like each a half pint of curdled 3-month-old glop dumped into it that taints all of this perfectly good milk.
Wow, that's a controversial assertion.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you're throwing a baby out, you and the bathwater.
It's the entire
bathroom you're throwing out.
Here's the thing. In the spectrum of hate to love, I'm mostly very, very much in the middle on Billy Joel. I like him just fine. I went through a period where I loved Billy Joel's music, but at this point, my positive opinions of Billy Joel are weaker than the negative associations with those songs.
I gotta say, that drum riff that goes with the motorcycles revving in Uptown Girl is one of the favorite memories of my high school years.
That drum roll
that
in
particular
one song.
That particular
That's so
thing.
Sad.
That's
I know, right?
Sad, sad.
Oh, shut up. Shut up, all of you.
High school.
Are you through? Have you had your fun? I heard you had a punching bag you wanted to mention.
Yes, I wanted to talk about it. Well, and here's
Gucci.
And here's where I will, of course, you know, I'm laying open my fish white belly for punchings and stabbings. I have a Billy of my own, a controversial Billy of my own, who was also making hits in the 1980s. Anybody care to guess who it
Billy
is?
Billy Ocean.
Vanilla Ice.
His name isn't Billy, but Billy Ocean, that's a good guess. It's not Billy Ocean. Not Billy Idol. Not Billy Vera. not of Billy Vera and the Beaters.
Billy Jean King.
Not Billy Jean King.
Billy Zane.
Not all Billy right, Zane. Just, Billy Squire.
Oh, that's right. I know this about you. I try to forget.
Billy Squire is very infrequently defended by music critics, and I think too infrequently defended. Now, he's not a Kardashian-level fork dropper, as shocking admissions of fandom are concerned. But if you go back, if you listen to Reach for the Sky, a Billy Squire anthology, there are actually some terrific songs. Jess, hit us with a little clip.
Step up, ladies.
Yeah, I don't know. I think those snaps were mic'd a little hot.
There are plenty of miking issues, I'm sure, with Billy Squire's music. And I realize, like, Billy Squire hit this tipping point in the mid-1980s around the Rock Me Tonight video.
Mm-hmm. I was going to bring that up.
In the slithering on the floor in, like, a pink tank top in an effort to appear more serpentine. Mm-hmm. I realize that such videos have made Billy Squire a bit of a punchline. But if you go back and listen to a bunch of his old, kind of early 80s stuff, the man had some great songs.
That video is the subject of the most fascinating part of the MTV oral history, I Want My MTV. A lot of different people talking about how bad that video was and how it almost single-handedly destroyed his career.
Yeah, it was...
Including him.
And the thing is, Rock Me Tonight was actually a pretty big hit. I mean, a lot of career-destroying songs are, I suppose, because they're ubiquitous. And yes, I realize, rock and roll, man! I mean, it's a, it's...
I love the idea...
Never that, do that again.
I love the idea that the tainting power of We Didn't Start the Fire is greater than power of the Rock Me Tonight video. You are ridiculous. I'm happy to see you, but you are ridiculous. You went off studying to be ridiculous when you got back.
I did.
Are you done?
Yeah.
Does anyone remember the topic?
Well,
Where does the stroke fit into your weird little equation?
Maybe it's Uptown Girl.
Don't make it worse. Okay. Because the thing is, we also have to get one other thing out of the way at the top of the show, which is it is Glenn's publication day.
Yay!
And we have talked for many months, many years.
I thought you were going to say we've talked for many minutes in this show.
Many years, it seems, we have been talking about waiting for Glenn's book to come out. So I did want to mention at the top of the show, Superman, the unauthorized biography.
You're a nice person.
Available now, one more time.
Right.
We're just telling you.
Yeah, wherever fine books are sold, and also mine.
And now, that's the story.
That's the story, yes. I'm trying to enjoy today and not take every piece of praise as disingenuous and every passing criticism as somehow reflecting on a deep character flaw that goes to my very core.
I find every passing criticism of that book to be a reflection of a character flaw in the person doing the criticism.
I agree. At any rate, so we did want to get that mentioned and sure that Glenn has a chance to appreciate his publication date.
This is a big day for you, buddy.
It is.
And I'll stop talking about it, so.
No, there's no reason to.
But our first topic, now that we've done everything else, is something I'm calling The Show Must Go On and On. And we came up with this in part because Mad Men is coming back this weekend as you receive this podcast for its sixth season. And I actually once wrote a piece, and I'll link to it on the blog. I wrote a piece years ago for MSNBC about the dreaded sixth season and how for many shows the sixth season is highly problematic. It was problematic for Buffy. It was problematic. I mean, it had high points for Buffy, but it also was problematic. It was problematic for The West Wing. It's problematic for a bunch of different shows.
And is that because the fifth season generally signifies syndication, and now that it's like the mountain has been...
I don't know if it's as specific as that, but what I'm trying to get at with this topic is very often when you go back and look at shows, it's surprising how frequently really super favorite episodes will be somewhere in the first season or two seasons. And it's not like they never hit highs again after that. I mean, the Buffy musical episode was
is the sixth.
And was way down the road. But very often, the time when people feel like, oh, they just were firing and firing and firing, and it was so creative and wild and great, will be in that first or second season. So the question is, how do you make your show last and last? That's the question I ask.
Well, one thing that occurred to me as we were doing homework for this was that shows like, for instance, Game of Thrones, which is also back, it's based on a series of novels in which not only is the author willing to take the reader way deep into territories that haven't been explored in the early books and invent whole new worlds three or four books in, he's also willing to kill off characters that you really like. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a writer who's that daring, that's certainly one way to keep something going.
Yeah, there was some of that on, I would say, on The Wire, too.
Mm-hmm.
There
was
some of that willingness to make large moves that other shows might not.
Right.
If I can bust out a tortured metaphor, may I?
You may.
It's what I
like
do.
Like you're going down.
Yeah. For a while there, the shows, even the serialized dramas, were simply iterations, week to week. L.A. Law, Hill Street Blues. Mm-hmm. They had the idea of an overarching storyline, but not really. They were pools that you kind of dive in, splash around in, and then get out. You're in the same place.
One and done.
Nowadays, shows are rivers that you dive into, you get carried along because there is an overarching story, and then you come out. When you come out of it at the end, you're someplace different. And the difference is, I think, the series Bible, which I'm sure, you know, Bonanza had a series Bible and Hill Street Blues. But these are things that the writers write at the very beginning of a show's career, which say, this is what the show is. These are who the characters are. This is where we want to go. If you look back at the end of a series run, there's a lot of stuff that isn't in the series Bible, because you discover things as you go. It's kind of what E.L. Doctorow said about writing a novel. You can only see ahead of you as far as your headlights go, but that's all you need to see, because you get to the end that way. But, for example, Ron Moore's series Bible for Battlestar Galactica is a fascinating document. You can find it online, because it's basically a reaction to his time writing for Star Trek The Next Generation. Much of this series Bible is, here's not what's going to happen. Right. That's not going to happen.
He's fighting the last war.
He is, and at one point he even says, and the Cylons are not the Borg. If you're ever in any doubt, just remember, they're not the Borg. Like, that's it. Now, all the stuff about the Final Five and what happens to Colonel Ty, all that stuff isn't in there. But there is this impetus to create a structure that'll last. Now, very few of these series Bibles consider a sixth season. It'll carry you through three or four seasons, and then you're in brave new territory.
I wonder if there's like an actual superstition about hubris, you know, so I can't possibly write a series Bible for seven seasons because then we'll die.
I think in Alan Sepinwall's book, I think it might be the guys from Lost. There is somebody who I think talks about that very point. Says you don't really want to. It feels a little jinxy to get to be like, here's what'll happen in the fourth season, and here's what'll happen in the fifth season. And I would say your Game of Thrones example is a little different because it's based on a series of novels that is an already existing longer story.
That story has already been written.
And I think you can look back even at something like Star Wars and say whatever people felt about the prequels when they went back and did those, the first three, I think everybody felt like it wasn't like the first one was good and then after that. And that's partly because that more of that story than just that first movie had been conceived of from the beginning.
Sure.
And I think there are certainly shows, if you take a show like Breaking Bad, I think certainly there was more in mind as far as where they wanted to go with all this than what was in that first season. Whereas with a show like The Killing or something like that, you wind up with these ones where they really just have that first swing in mind, or it seems like they do. And they get to the end, and then you have to figure out what would be next. And for some shows, they've really managed to make that work. Like, the, as we mentioned, The Wire sort of did these contained, there was an arc that stretched across all five seasons, but they were quite compartmentalized. Each of those seasons, you had the one season, and then there would be the season on the docks, and then the season in the schools, and you know,
season
so
with the newspaper.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think it does help when you can pick up a new story for a new season, as opposed to just trying. One of the things I admire a lot about Mad Men is they've really just been kind of stretching out that story and telling that story over and over and over again, and more of it, without being like, okay,
here's
this
the arc
is the
of
end.
Our season.
Right. Here's the end, and here's a new beginning. There's a little bit of that when they change the agency stuff, but not really.
But he's built a very, very clever framework for that show, which is that he's begun it at the end of one very clearly defined social era. And he's moving through this time of immense change on the domestic landscape. So he's got lots to work with and lots to bounce these characters off
That's exactly what I was going to say. Because 1962 is a different country than 1968.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what Trey said. If you bounce these characters against these different cultures, you're going to get different reactions.
Right. And it gives you almost that same framework like you get from working on Game of Thrones, where there are already books written. If you know that you already have social change that's going to come along, that you don't have to make up. You know, the civil rights movement is happening anyway. Vietnam is happening anyway. Someday.
Yeah, call it the Forrest Gump model.
Exactly. Where you don't have to do it. Yeah. And so I wonder whether that is one of the big weapons in their arsenal in that way.
Well, you know, talking about sort of the secrets to longevity, I started thinking about, well, what are the longest running shows and why? And one thing that I noticed in terms of how does a show survive into 8, 9, 10 seasons, one thing that I've found often happens with a lot of the shows that do is there is an element in terms of how they stay fresh is they decline and then get better. And then decline, and then get better.
Yeah.
And you start to get, with certain shows, particularly more with comedies, and Saturday Night Live is a great example of this, where the show continues to exist out of habit. And it doesn't go away, in part, out of habit. And then, you know, people can kind of jump in and out of it. And when there's suddenly a good episode, like I heard recently, like somebody really loved a new episode of Glee. And I sort of felt like Glee had
I was just going to ask if anybody ever had said that Glee had experienced a creative resurgence. So I'm
glad you brought that up. But hasn't it?
Episode to episode, it has. And that's, I think, the question is, how do you differentiate between, as we said, even shows in decline can often produce a really good episode. Many good shows that decline, people can still identify a favorite episode from very late in the run. I think it's hard to it's too early to tell with Glee, I think, whether they're capable of playing out some of that stuff into a more persistent thing or whether that's just more of their total unevenness that show has always had that's stuck out more and more.
But I think that unevenness does sometimes feed into longevity, that people will stick with a show or they'll drop out and try it again. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you've got your Simpsons and your Saturday Night Live and your South Park, you know, which is South Park. I mean, that thing has been around, what, like 16 seasons or something like that. Now that, you know, and that's a unique case in that it's so few people are involved in the creative side of it. But it's very tricky because there are so many forces at work keeping shows, you know, from staying the same.
Do you think that years ago people would be watching Gunsmoke and be thinking, oh, geez, it's going downhill.
That is a great question.
I can't imagine. Because that was 25 years or something like that? Crazy like that?
Yeah, I think there is a great question to be asked about whether people are just much more, well, I don't think there's any question that they are much more attuned than they used to be to the episode to episode. This was a good one. This was a bad one. And then if there's about three in a row they don't like, they're like, oh, this sucks now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Or I don't like the direction this is going this season. Where I think for a long time when shows were more, as Stephen says, when more of it was habit-driven and more of it was just this is what's on at this time and this is what I sit down and watch at 8 o'clock on Tuesdays, then you wouldn't necessarily constantly take the temperature of everything you're watching.
Right.
In part because you didn't have so many choices. There weren't so many things luring you away. You
and
wouldn't necessarily have the reason to sit down and be like, do I still want to watch this or am I going to switch? I mean, you had your people who watched ABC Tuesday and your people who watched something else on Tuesday.
Right.
And there wasn't a lot of sort of, well, this week but not next week and I don't like where this season is going. Like, you would be a loyalist for years and years and years.
Well, and you didn't have all your friends talking about how now this show sucks.
Right, right.
You know, you didn't have quite the peer pressure in the the form of instant reaction.
You know, I'm sorry if you're talking about Gunsmoke, especially if you're talking about, like, the 60s, then, and if you were watching it in color, then just the novelty factor of the thing was still pretty high, right?
Well, and expectations for television also used to be, I think, much lower artistically. I mean, expectations for television, if you go back and watch ordinary sitcoms of the 80s that 20 million people watched, they're not any good.
It was terrible. Yeah.
But standards were, people didn't sit around worrying about why did people watch Full House as much as they would now.
Right.
You know, that 20 million people would watch Full House. I mean, I know that people who considered themselves the cultural elite would sit around and be horrified by that. But there wasn't as much like, because the show is bad because I didn't like that Amnesia episode, you know? And it's sort of, there is an Amnesia episode.
Of course there is.
Everyone knows that. Everyone who just heard me say that who knows that is really, really amused at my expense right now. But my point being, I think people did used to pause less to sort of think about, do I want to, when am I going to quit this show?
And expectations are a huge part of it, because if you consider the original Law and Order, that show is a procedural, that show has a formula, and that formula is what satisfies. And when, and we've, I think we've talked about this before, but when they try to dig into Jack's personal life, or and it's like, what are you doing? This is not why I watch the show. I don't care what Jack does at home.
Get back to the chalk outline.
And there are times when I would disagree with you about shows in that way. But that show, I agree with you completely. Yeah. I never wanted to follow them home. There would be little tastes of it that I sometimes thought were fine and gave you a little glimpse. And that's probably one of the reasons I never got bored with that show. I never got tired of watching Law and Order at all.
That show is all about guessing whether there's going to be another twist after the first twist and whether they're going to convict or not convict.
Well, is this a fake out or not a fake out?
Right. Yeah. And it's all about the cast. I mean, it's all about, like, I don't watch the Dennis Farina ones just because I just don't. But I will watch any Jerry Orbach one.
Sure. But Law and Order is a show that really has had it both ways in terms of there's a predictable formula, and yet the show in part, I think, survived and stayed fresh by staying in flux with its cast.
Right.
You know, and I think a show like CSI has really been able to do much the same thing. I mean, there are just eras of that show with mm-hmm. a different heavy protagonist, whether it's Lawrence Fishburne or Ted Danson or William Peterson.
Is that the one with Mariska Hargitay? I just wanted to say Mariska Hargitay.
That's SVU.
Okay.
Yeah. That's SVU.
Well, this gets us into a tangent of soap operas, where the characters age. You see the characters age, they pair off, they die, they come back with
a
different
face. And then they mysteriously unage.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because you are constantly iterating and reiterating, and what attracts you are the characters' relationships, and it's just the pull of story without ending. Stuff happens, and then other stuff happens,
as opposed
to a story with an arc.
And talk about habit. I mean, I was talking online to a couple of people about the fact that when I saw that General Hospital was doing some festivities around their 50th anniversary this week, I looked at an episode. Now, it turns out this is misleading because they've brought a bunch of people back for the 50th anniversary. So there were many more people there, apparently, that I recognized than would normally be there. But you go there and you look at it, and it's just shocking. I mean, you just feel like they're still arguing. That guy and that guy still hate each other. Seriously, there was still a Scotty and Luke and Laura thing happening, which dates back to the 70s. I mean, it is amazing how long they drag this stuff out, but it's absolutely true that the familiarity of it and the habit of it feed into that.
Is Luke's hairline still receding?
They're doing all kinds of stuff.
He's got a Bret Michaels style bandana stretched over the top of his head.
He's got a new look now. He's settled into his sort of old Luke look. And as I said to my good pal Joe Reed, I was like, well, you know, I'm happy to see all these people again. They do appear to have been busy going to the dermatologist.
They may or may not resemble skeletons with skin stretched over them.
Some of them look a little done. Some of them look a little done. But, you know, a show like Mad Men, I think they've done surprisingly well.
Sure.
I have not really gotten bored with that show overall. There have been individual pieces of it where I've been like, I don't care as much about this. But I don't feel like I don't like this show anymore.
But do you find that the idea of a story arc is kind of infiltrating things like sitcoms nowadays? Like, that's what I find odd. Like, How I Met Your Mother has at its core a central mystery that they pay a little lip service to every now and again, but that's theoretically what's driving the show. Friends even had these different people, are they going to hook up or not, Ross and Rachel stuff. I mean, and certainly Cheers, which we've just talked about.
Right.
This idea of an arc as opposed to just moving these characters around on a chessboard.
Well, it's interesting that you'd bring that up because I do think, and this is not, I don't in any way to revisit this, but I do think a lot of that thing about Cheers and Simpsons and all that has to do with that. Based on what I have read, Cheers was really a major mover in the idea that stories would evolve. And in that case, it was the romantic story. But then you would get shows like Roseanne, which we talked about too, which had long stories that weren't love stories. They were stuff like, you know, who in the family currently had a job and didn't have a job, and did they have any money? And when they didn't have money for a long time, all of a sudden you would get an episode where the electricity got turned off.
So
things would happen that had stakes over time. And I do think that that grew, especially with comedies that had couples. I think that got, especially after Sam and Diane, that became a very popular way to frame it. And you're right that How I Met Your Mother is perhaps the most high concept example of that, although to me, for reasons I've explained elsewhere, that's always been kind of beside the point.
One of my favorite ensemble comedies of the last 15 years, and I know a couple of y'all are going to snort, but is Boston Legal, in part because of the sheer talent that was assembled to make that show, that, you know, such quirky personalities. And one of the things that it adopted, I think, from shows like L.A. Law and Law & Order is the three-episode arc. Right? That lets you bring a guest star in, like Michael J. Fox, and tell a slightly extended story that's, while the show remains basically a one-and-done kind of thing, where you have a case, and it ends, and you have a case, and it ends. That is a compact kind of storytelling, but still lets you stretch out.
The Good Wife does that.
And Hill Street Blues did that. There are a few others that have done sort of like 2-4 episode arcs.
I'm just kind of thinking about the sitcoms that sort of lifted that from the hour-long drama.
I do think it's much more common in sitcoms now, as Glenn said. And The Simpsons, as an example, you know, in the Cheers versus The Simpsons, The Simpsons, part of The Simpsons' formula is that it has to sort of return to the starting point at the end of each episode, to the point where they do a lot of meta commentary on that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Most of the shows that I can think of that have lasted and lasted for many years have at least some blend of that episodic and perhaps, you know, I mean, even if you think about something like Little House on the Prairie, mm-hmm. you know, there certainly were things over time that, you know, people would have different jobs and go blind or whatever that would that would last over arcs. But for the most part, this was the one where they went to hit the play, and this is the one where they find the dog, and this is the one where they think they found gold. And, you know, so it's that blend of episodic and and serialized where I think some of the ones that struggle the most with time now are the ones that are strictly serialized. But you should come and find us on Facebook and tell us what you think about this and the longevity of shows and ultimately what you think of the new season of Mad Men. That's fair. Indeed. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. Okay, so the other thing we were going to talk about this week, this past weekend, G.I. Joe Retaliation opened in your local theater.
And made $117 billion.
Well, it made $40 million in its opening weekend, according to Box Office Mojo, to be the second highest Easter weekend opening ever, just behind Clash of the Titans.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Now, 2009 was G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra. Mm-hmm. So even the original one also had the little colon, mm-hmm. you know. They were way ahead of the game.
Oh, yeah.
You couldn't just have G.I. Joe.
Mm-mm. Right.
Everyone had to have its own thing. G.I. Joe Retaliation includes The Rock.
Yes.
And I think diminished presence for Channing Tatum, if I'm understanding.
Yes, I believe that he exits the movie early.
Yeah, that's what I have heard.
Spoiler.
So then,
you know, shouting spoiler after you divulge a piece of information, I'm not sure how useful that is.
I'm just going to say that most of our listeners probably do not care.
Well, and honestly...
Well, you can't.
No. I think the point is more to me that the stress in the marketing has been that this is a movie about The Rock.
Yes.
Okay.
So one way or the other, it's going to become a movie about The Rock.
About The Rock and Bruce Willis.
Exactly. The Rock and Bruce Willis. So this got us thinking about our prejudices, mm-hmm. I want to say.
Because starting with Trey talking about whether people who listen to the show watch G.I. Joe
movies. I suppose some might enjoy it.
Fine.
For those that like that sort of thing, the sort of thing that they like.
Oh, shut up. I will have you know, I was talking about this with a friend as we were deciding which movie to go see this weekend, and I said, I will happily watch that movie when it is available to me to rent for $3.
Just think how prepared you could have been for this episode, right?
Where is Mike Katzif with the slow clap when you need him? So here's what we were thinking about. You look at the movie, G.I. Joe, Retaliation. It's got The Rock, and I look at it and I think, there's red flags all over this movie.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right? Second part of a franchise replacing the lead.
Right.
Which, incidentally, has happened to The Rock before in the direct-to-DVD sequel to Tooth Fairy.
I was just going
to
say Tooth Fairy.
In which, for Tooth Fairy 2, The Rock was replaced by Larry the Cable Guy. Maybe my favorite thing that's ever happened in a direct-to-DVD sequel.
Now, the sequel to Tooth Fairy is not called, like, Tooth Fairy.
Oh, it should be.
Yeah, what a missed opportunity.
You know, it looks like it's just called, from what I saw today, it looks like it's just called Tooth Fairy 2. Not even like Tooth Fairy 2, by cuspid, by Jehoshaphat, or something like that. Like,
that's, yeah.
What
that's
you really want perfect. Is a Tooth Fairy Christmas. All I want is by two. Something dumb.
Exactly.
Like
but instead, they basically went with Tooth Fairy 2.
Exactly. And so we were thinking, what are the signs that make you look at a movie, the more cosmetic, mm-hmm. and make you just say, it's going to be a problem.
I'm out ahead of time.
It's going to be a problem.
Well, does it begin with the words, in a world?
Well, yeah. But
the trailer
But don't they all?
But no movie would.
Well, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about the trailer, right?
Okay, well, let's...
What are the signs in the trailer?
To some degree.
I brought a big list of deal breakers. but Linda mentioned...
It's a deal breaker, ladies.
That's right. Linda mentioned recasting the leads. Mm-hmm. And I was starting to think, like, what are bad sequels in which the leads are recast? Dumb and Dumberer, When Harry Met Lloyd.
Oh. That even was a thing.
Home Alone 3.
Oh,
without
that's
Macaulay
right.
Culkin.
That's right. Huh. With that little kid who was in One Fine Day. I think.
Speed 2.
Oh, yeah.
Cruise Control with
Speed
Jason Patrick.
Speed 2 is, yeah.
That
Speed
is a 4 knots. And then like 5 seconds later, 3 knots. That was suspense in that movie.
Yeah, Speed 2 is pretty bad.
No, wait, that's all I wrote down.
How about Bring It On Again?
There are
like 4 direct-to-DVD sequels to Bring It On.
Well, and I think there are... Okay, you touch on a great point. There are certain words when tacked onto titles of sequels that imply a certain amount of... again, two...
still.
Still. reloaded. Now, when I say two, I mean T-O-O.
Sure.
Oh, God.
Look Who's Talking To.
But there are some ones that you admire their courage. Pig in the City. Come on. That's pretty good. Electric Boogaloo. These are all the classic.
Well, Electric Boogaloo. Yeah, sure. I mean, that made that movie.
Yes, of course. Legend of Curly's Gold.
The community center made Electric Boogaloo. The break into Electric Boogaloo, I have seen in a theater. And they saved the community center. It's
sure they
very,
did.
Very dramatic. I'm sorry, go ahead, Glenn.
The Next Day.
Yeah, The Next Day.
The Revenge, as in Jaws the Revenge, of course. Uh-huh. But you know what? I have a theory of what the finest sequel title is. Not because it's funny, but just because it's so ruthlessly efficient. Any guesses?
I mean, Porky's 2, The Next Day is a pretty good example.
No, the sequel actually is it's right on the nose, but I'll give you that.
The sequel.
The best sequel title ever. A friend of the show, Chris Klinik, will argue for Die Hard with a Vengeance. I say nay. Mm-hmm. Aliens.
Yeah.
Simple. It tells you what
example.
You need to know.
Well, no.
It is not fussy.
No.
It just gets
just
right
implies,
to
like,
it.
The same but more.
Right, exactly.
But I would argue the problem with Aliens is it requires you to refer to the movie as Aliens.
Aliens with a Z?
It doesn't. Three
aliens.
Z's.
They save the community center.
I prefer the title Aliens to Alien Cubed.
Yeah.
Well, and that's I would argue that sometimes when they get into these sequels and they're trying to name them, the problem that you get is that it winds up being a title that you can distinguish on a poster. But that if you actually talk about the movie, it is like Alien Cubed. Right. And I feel the same way about Aliens. Like if you're talking about a movie and you say to people like, oh yeah, that happened in Aliens, they're not even necessarily going to hear which one you said.
Right.
And you're going to have to go back and go, I'm sorry, did you say Alien or Aliens?
It's sort of like the way Peter Gabriel named 4 albums Peter Gabriel. Right. All the movies are just called Alien.
George Foreman's sons.
That's right.
All of George Foreman's sons are named George Foreman, by the way, including his grill.
But if somebody came up to you and said Alien Cube, you wouldn't even know what they're talking about.
You would say Alien 3.
You would say Alien 3. And I have heard people say Alien 2, even though that is very wrong.
you walked away from them without another word.
But you know what's a tip-off from me? When I seen a trailer, the words... from the producers of.
Right. Right.
That doesn't mean anything. That's not a thing.
From the executive who greenlit Caddyshack.
It's like from the studio that brought you. No.
Well,
from the general geographic area which.
I saw one recently that said from a producer of.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Wow. That is some thin gruel when it comes to promoting that connection.
All right, another deal breaker.
But really, Hollywood, we love you.
Yeah. Yes, of course. The extension of what is already a ridiculous plot. And I am thinking specifically of Weekend at Bernie's 2.
Sure, well.
Like, we found another dead body.
Same
to
dead body.
Parade around.
Right. Still Bernie, I think. I think it's still Bernie. I think they gave that actor another go.
Terry Kaiser gets another go around.
What happens in Weekend at Bernie's 2? Does anyone know?
I can't imagine that any of us knows, right?
I have a pretty good idea.
I think it involves a body.
What happens in Weekend at Bernie's 2, she asks.
I thought maybe that was the one where, like, they got serious or something like that. Weekend at Bernie's 2.
All it is the funeral service.
That's right.
Okay, actually, I'm gonna weigh in with a competitor for Glenn's best sequel ever, Hamlet 2.
I've heard good things.
But it's a really funny movie, and it's a joke.
That's
it's
the
a
joke,
joke
of the movie,
sequel,
right?
Right?
Uh-huh. Right. That's a good idea.
All right,
I like it.
Another one. The original stars are barely in it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That happened in Step Up to the Streets.
Yeah. Caddyshack 2.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Suffers from that. Like, Chevy Chase, like, swings by, and that's what you get.
He swung by to pick up $10
million. Yeah, exactly.
Was there a Meatballs 2? Am I hallucinating that?
I believe there was.
Huh. Yeah, I just realized, I just found out today there was a Roadhouse 2.
Mm-hmm. Is Swayze in it?
No.
And, of course, the sequel to...
Because Swayze could have been in it.
He could have. The sequel to Dirty Dancing, Havana Nights.
Written by...
Peter Sagal.
Written by Peter Sagal.
What? How is that the case? How did I not know that?
He has told this story many times.
Yeah, he wrote Dirty Dancing 2, Havana Nights.
They changed it.
Yeah. His script was masterful.
They had some notes.
Okay, but Dirty Dancing, Havana Nights.
He meant for it to be political satire.
It was searing. Yeah. The original script was searing.
And full of jokes.
No, but Dirty Dancing, Havana Nights fits into another category I wanted to bring up, which is the incredibly long delayed sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
right.
So Dirty Dancing, Havana Nights, Blues Brothers 2000,
oh, yeah.
The Sting 2.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I forgot that.
There's another one.
Jackie Gleason was in that,
yeah,
right?
Jackie Gleason was mm-hmm. in the
wow.
Sting 2.
Mm-hmm.
Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace.
Oh, yeah. Don't even go there.
Oh, yeah, that's another category. It has Jar Jar Binks in
right.
it.
Well, which actually sort of gets to something that I was going to say, which is if in the trailer there is more than a minute of CGI that I cannot parse,
yeah.
if I can't figure out what's going on in the fight scenes or the CGI, then there is not a chance you're going to drag yeah. me to see that, not even at yeah. a free press screen.
So like a battleship? That's not actually a sequel, but...
Yeah. Well, and it's funny that you would mention that because, speaking of G.I. Joe, one of the things I realized when I went back and read my review of G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra, which I reviewed but completely had forgotten everything about it, one of the things that I had said about it is it has those action sequences that are now very popular. I feel like I'm about to start sounding about 80 years old, but where... You know, the cuts are so fast
yeah.
that I can't orient myself in the actual physical space. And so it's not a compelling action sequence to
right.
me because I have no idea where I am. I know. Glenn is giving me this look like.
I'm just picturing you with a shawl.
Oh, grandma's telling her stories.
And your hair up in a bun.
Hey, I prefer if you're going to make a board game movie, just make it Monopoly. That's
what I think. Actually happening, though?
Mahjong.
Yeah, I think
I
so.
Wouldn't be surprised.
I don't need this battleship. Just make me a nice game out of careers. That's a very nice game. Careers.
Euchre.
Careers. I know you can't make a game out of euchre, but you could make a game out of careers. That's a good game.
One of the stars directing the movie. And I'm thinking specifically of William Shatner directing Star Trek The Final Frontier.
Well, now you can't. Because Leonard Nimoy directed a good one, didn't he?
Oh, that's true. I like Nimoy's. That's right.
So Stephen just means William Shatner.
So I just mean William Shatner's
just William
director.
It just means an actor you're not particularly fond of.
I got nothing against Shatner.
A film de William Shatner.
Yeah, I'm going to argue that's not necessarily a warning sign. Ben Affleck and Argo.
That's true.
I'm not saying that no movie star. I'm saying
take
if
it back.
It's Star Trek V and it's directed by Shatner, it's probably not going to be awesome.
Take
right.
it back. They're going to have a fist
take
fight
it
over
back. You know, I never thought that Trey Graham and I would resort to fisticuffs, and I certainly did not expect it to be over that.
Over a Shatner movie.
Over William Shatner. Trey Graham as William Shatner's lawyer. Well, I think we have made a very good and very thorough list of sequel problems.
Red flags. Call them red flags.
Red flags.
Yeah. They don't doom the movie, they just...
I was going to say, and our whole point is, you can turn out to be wrong, you
yep.
know?
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of any particularly great examples right at the moment.
But there are.
But oh, you wait. Out there will think of them. Trey Graham has his hand up.
I have one more. If it stars Tom Cruise and he's playing a character named Jack, which
yeah.
he has done in, what, the last
every
five movies?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's true. But you out there probably have, A, your own sequel red flags, and B, your own examples of sequels that have defied these red flags, and
we would
like to hear about them on Facebook or on the blog, so come and see us and tell us all about it.
You know, that's actually one movie that does defy. Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol is a good movie.
It's true. It's got a silly name.
Mission: Impossible: Ghost: Protocol.
And you can't say any movie with a colon in it is bad because people like Human Centipede. Hey, lady!
Boo. I cast thee out.
It's the thing in the lady.
You are the worst person in the world. All right. Well, that does bring us to our final segment.
Don't say the end.
I just yelled segment because I realized where that was going.
That brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week? Other than just how happy we are to see you back.
It's good to be back. Well, so certain am I of what is making Linda Holmes happy that I brought a different example. We'll get to it.
Sure.
But it is also making me happy.
Sure.
I was in Wisconsin last week for my vacation and spent a bunch of time with my dear mother, whom you all know from this podcast. And she reminded me of a performer I loved as a kid and had completely and utterly forgotten. And she found some clips of his on his website and on YouTube. It is a juggler, a comedy juggler named Michael Davis. Does anybody remember Michael Davis?
Nope. Not at all.
Jess, hit me.
Now, to make juggling a bowling ball more interesting, I've decided to combine it with an egg. Natural enemy of a bowling ball. People wonder, is it a real egg? Never mind. The third ordinary object, an apple. The bowling ball apple egg juggle. Now, the real trick to this is not simply juggling the three objects, but during the juggle to grab a bite out of the apple. And not the bowling ball.
Or the egg, presumably.
I remember this guy now, I do.
Yeah, he just this wonderful deadpan delivery. Lots and lots of, I mean, it's tricky to excerpt a juggler on a podcast.
Yeah.
But just wonderfully wry and dry and fun. And I was amazed watching a 10-minute clip on YouTube that I remembered every single joke, even though I had forgotten who he was.
And prop comedy that works.
It's sharp, funny prop comedy, and I find him delightful. He has a website, michaeldavisentertainment.com, and I highly recommend digging up those clips.
Wonderful.
Awesome.
Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
A thing that, believe it or not, I did not know existed. I warn you now, it may involve costumes and drama. But there is.
I'm shocked.
There is.
Knock me over with a feather from a hat.
Yeah. Hey, I've been away for a couple of weeks.
You have.
The Scarlet Pimpernel was a CBS miniseries that aired in, I believe, 1982. It originated in the UK, of course. It stars Anthony Andrews in the title role. Anthony Andrews is the guy from the original Brideshead Revisited, if you recall. Jane Seymour is Marguerite St. Just, and an infant Ian McKellen is Citizen Chauvelin.
Wow, really?
It has recently been reissued by our friends at Acorn Media, available on DVD and possibly Blu-ray, I can't recall. But Scarlet Pimpernel.
Wonderful.
We seek him here, we seek him there.
Fantastic. Glenn Weldon, what do you seek here, there, and everywhere? What is making you happy this week?
Well, obviously, I mean, we already talked about it, but the book, Superman, the Unauthorized Biography, came out this week. And, you know, it's been a long slog to get this thing done. It's finally out. It's a huge relief. You know, back in the 70s, there was a movie starring Billy Crystal, directed by Joan Rivers, called Rabbit Test, in which Billy Crystal played the world's first pregnant man. Mm. One of the many things that Billy Crystal did long before Arnold Schwarzenegger. he was Mr. Olympia years before. And the only advertising this film got was a commercial of Joan Rivers staring into the camera saying, "Go see it, I'm a mother." So that's the way I feel. go buy this book. I'm a mother. Didn't work for the film. Yeah. Film flopped. Mm-hmm. But let's try it here. But the main thing I want to talk about is a documentary called The Bitter Buddha. It's a documentary about the comedian Eddie Pepitone.
Eddie Pepitone is
a mentally ill.
He's completely relevant to this young, new comedy.
He's really like the real deal. He's like the guitarist that all the other guitarists go to see.
I'm going to say right at the start that Eddie Pepitone will not be to everybody's taste, who is now listening to the sound of my voice, but he is genetically engineered in a secret underground lab to appeal to my humor receptors. He is hilarious. He is a comics comic, kind of a grouchy dude. That's his thing. But this film is just about this guy who's been around forever, who's finally coming into his own now. It's really great. It takes a while to find its story. But man, the ending really lands hard. It's a small moment, but it's a great moment, and it's a really fascinating look at a career in comedy and a very, very funny dude. It's called The Bitter Buddha.
Excellent. Hmm. I will seek it out. Okay, so Stephen said that he was very confident was going to be making me happy this week, and I'm sure that he is right. The first thing making me happy this week is the chicken ears, which was a bit that they did on Jimmy Fallon's show, in which Jimmy Fallon, Nick Offerman from Parks and Recreation, Blake Shelton from The Voice, and another guy
who did not credit quite
so much.
But it's basically just a storm of goodwill on the stage,
are all dressed up in giant chicken suits, and they sing...
As you do.
Yeah. And they sing The Lumineers, Ho Hey, and it's all as chickens. So it's all clucking. It's one of those things. I mean, I've gone on plenty about Jimmy Fallon and his use of music, but it's the kind of show where people are sitting around, someone has this idea, and instead of somebody saying, that's a stupid idea.
That's really lame.
That's a dumb idea.
Somebody says, here's $10,000, make it happen.
Somebody says, no. Imagine. Here's Jimmy, here's Nick Offerman, here's Blake Shelton, and here's the other guy. I apologize.
Here's the other guy.
And here's...
And they're all singing as chickens. And you can tell, you know exactly what happened, which is the first thing they thought of was how they'd just be going at the hey and the ho that Stephen and I have shared so many times, that it would just be hilarious to just be going.
But it's also one of those things, it's 2 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's dumb and it flops.
And it is.
Of course it's dumb. But I mean, but if it isn't wonderful, which how could it not be wonderful?
It's wonderful.
It's 2 minutes.
Right. So that's the first thing making me happy this week. And many people brought that. I don't know that so many people have brought something to my attention since, I don't know, the last thing that people thought I was going to love from Jimmy Fallon's show. So that's A. B is that this weekend I got to spend some time with my sister's family. And on Friday night, I curled up on the couch with my nephews, and my sister and her husband were there, and we watched Mission Impossible 3.
Mm.
And it was funny because we made slight mention of Mission Impossible and the sequels. And
that's the one with the fancy cars in the running, right?
Thank you, Troy.
It's the one with Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
And the thing that's so great about Mission Impossible 3, well, okay, first, yes, it is Tom Cruise running. Tom Cruise running, as I said on Twitter, should be in every movie. It's so funny and so great, and I love it. But sitting around with family, the boys had never seen it before. They're 11 and 14. And they had never seen it. So they're enjoying the movie for the first time. And I had not watched it in a while. And it's like, hey, I forgot Felicity's in this movie. Oh, hey, you know. And different people are. And Philip Seymour Hoffman, like I said, is in this movie as the bad guy. And it's a pretty engaging action movie. It's, you know, J.J. Abrams. And it was good. And we enjoyed it. And it was family fun. Sitting around with a couple of boys.
I would say I hope that's a sturdy 11-year-old, because Philip Seymour Hoffman is actually kind of a creepy bad guy in that. He's actually kind of scary.
Yeah, he's a pretty sturdy 11-year-old.
He's kind of
scary. He's a pretty tough kid. He's seen worse.
Yeah.
He's seen worse. Those kids grew up watching Tremors.
Yeah, so. We should have a nephew off.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mine are the best, I'm sorry. So that is what's making me happy this week, and that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at IDislikeStephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham exactly like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at GHWeldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, GITNER. And you can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are listening to right now. I love it when I get to read off everybody's name at the end, because we're all here together. Thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.